Let us return back to our story in 1 Samuel chapter number 30, starting at verse number 11. Remember that David has come back to Ziklag and discovered that it's been raided by the Amalekites. His wives and the wives and the kids of his fellow warriors have been kidnapped and taken away as slaves. So David immediately mobilizes and heads south to track this raiding party down and do a rescue. Now, as they get ready to cross the Wadi Besor, which is at least part of a day's journey south of Ziklag, about a third of his forces are so exhausted from the traveling they've been doing for several days now that they can't continue and be an effective fighting force. So David leaves those 200 guys at the Wadi Besor in charge of the things they've been carrying, their equipment. And this allows David and his men to move even faster. So they stay on the trail of the raiding party and they find someone. 1 Samuel 30, verse 11. They found an Egyptian in the open country, so out in the middle of nowhere, and they brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate. And they gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So they give him everything he needs in order to kind of get his strength back up, because he must have been in a really bad way. When he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. David said to him, "To whom do you belong? Where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite. My master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid against the Negeb of the Kiritites, and against that which belongs to Judah, and against the Negeb of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." So this raiding party has ranged over the southern part of Judean territory, even over by Hebron, apparently. But the more important thing, as far as David is concerned, is that they hit Ziklag. So he knows that he's on the right track to catch the raiding party that has their people. So David said to him, "Will you take me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you'll not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I'll take you down to this band." So David wants him to be a guide, to basically show him the raiding camps, the raiding campsites that this band has used in the past. Because more than likely, they're creatures of habit. They're going to go back to them on their way back to their home. So the guy agrees, provided he is not traded for the hostages or killed. And David apparently agrees. So, verse 16, "When he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah." So they find this group at one of their habitual campsites, and they're just partying down. Why are they partying down? Because they don't think they have anything to fear. The largest portion of the Philistine fighting force is several days to the north, marching against the breadbasket of Israel in the plains of Megiddo and the valley of Jezreel. So they have nothing to worry about from the Philistines whom they raided. And a large portion of the Judean army and the Israeli army are also up in the north at Jezreel, trying to prevent the Philistines from taking things up there. So these guys figure they don't even have to be quiet at their camp as they retreat back to where they came from, because there's no threat anywhere near them. But how wrong they are. Verse number 17. David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. So the twilight we're talking about, probably later afternoon as the sun's declining. And then the evening of the next day, remember that for Israelis, the next day starts at sunset. So effectively, for several hours, David attacks them from late afternoon until sometime before full dark. And the only ones that get away are about 400 of the younger ones who manage to get to their camels and ride off into the night. And so David recovered all the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. So David brought back all. And David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before them and said, "This is David's spoil." So not only did David get all of his people and things back, he got everything that the Amalekites had stolen on their raid, and he takes that back with him. Verse 21. Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor. And they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. And then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, "Well, because they didn't go with us, we're not going to give them any of the spoil that we've recovered, except they can each have his own wife and child and depart." Now, this lets us see into the attitudes of at least some of these people that are working with David. Unfortunately, they are self-centered, and they are in this situation for their own benefit. So they don't see this as kind of a let's make things right movement. They see this as I want to get mine movement, and David is my means of doing that. So they basically count the 200 guys that didn't go with them as cowards and worthless and not helpful to the cause. And they can just have their wives and their kids, and they can go away. They can just leave because we don't need them. Now, David is not of that attitude. Verse 23, David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what he who is has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays with the baggage. They shall share alike." And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel that from that day forward to this day. So David's response is, we're not going to be that way. God is the one that gave us this victory. And we are going to share the proceeds of the victory with those that were with our stuff here. Yes, they weren't fighting with us against the Amalekites, but they were here taking care of things. So from here on out, this is the way it's going to be. Those that go into the active battle and those who do the behind-the-scenes stuff, who do the support, are all going to be treated as equals, and they will get paid the same. And so that becomes the rule in Israel from that moment forward, as far as David's kingdom was concerned. And I think that is eminently fair, because it's important to have support personnel. Frontline fighters can't do their stuff well unless behind the scenes people, behind the lines people are taking care of business for them. This is something that the military understands. You've got to have support personnel who feed the troops and house the troops and clean the troops' clothing and keep the troops' armor and their weapons in good working order and keep them healthy. You've got to have all of that background stuff, or the fighting troops are worthless. They won't get their job done. All right, back to the text. Verse 26, when David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of he who is. It was for those in Bethel, in Ramot of the Negeb, in Yaptir, in Erior, in Sifmaut, in Eshtemoa, in Rakel, in the cities of the Yerameelites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Horma, in Borashan, in Atak, in Hebron, for all the places where David and all his men had roamed. So David takes a large portion of the spoils and he sends it over to Judah, the very place that had been raided by the Philistines and by these Amalekites and by other groups in the Sinai, and that David was more than willing to defend them from. And he's wanting them to know, I'm still fighting for God. I'm still fighting for you. So it would appear that David arrived back at Ziklag 2 days before the battle at Mount Gilboa up in the north. So this effectively means that David is about 3 days' journey south of where Saul is going to die, and David is busy with all of the follow-up work once he arrived at Ziklag. Because remember, when he arrived at Ziklag 2 days before the battle, he sees that there's all sorts of things that he has to take care of with this raiding crew. The defeating the Amalekites, I think, took place on the day before the Battle of Mount Gilboa. And David came back victorious to Ziklag from defeating the Amalekites on the same day as the Battle of Mount Gilboa. And so this is one of the reasons why it's so hard for us to tell this story, is because you've got so many things happening at the exact same time, but far apart. Let's now go back to 1 Samuel 28 and read about what happened the day before the battle in the life of Saul. All right, so David is down fighting the Amalekites when this happened. Starting at verse 3, we get a little background material. Now Samuel had died, all Israel had mourned for him, and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had put the mediums and the necromancers out of the land. That's important to know for the story that we're about to read. So Samuel is dead, he's been dead for weeks, perhaps several months. And Saul, during his time on the throne, has done one good thing. And that is, he has made it illegal, as the law says, for spiritists to operate openly. Necromancers, mediums, those who try to contact the spirit world. Okay, now, verse 4, the Philistines assembled and came and encamped at Shunem. And Saul gathered his army, and they encamped at Gilboa. So this is up in the valley of Jezreel. Shunem is on the north, and Jezreel is on the south, about 4 maybe 5 miles apart, depending on exactly where the different camps were located. And they're going to be going to battle the next day. Verse 5, when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart trembled greatly. So there's that great big army to his north, and he figures he's in big trouble. Verse 6, when Saul inquired of he who is did not answer him either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. Now this has been the case for years. Ever since the Spirit of God abandoned Saul, God won't talk to him. So we're talking about almost 18 years now that God has not talked to him through the Urim and the Thummim, or through dreams, or through a prophet named Samuel. Verse 7, Saul said to his servants, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." So Saul talks to his inner circle, says, "I need someone that can call up the dead. Find me a woman that can do that." His servant said to him, "Behold, there is a medium at Endor." Now, this Endor, we don't know 100% sure where it's at, but there was a city of Dor on the heights of Dor, just a few miles south and west of the Israeli encampment at Jezreel. About 10 miles is where I place it. And so in just simply means waters or spring of. So probably about 10 miles away, they know that there's this spiritist woman that practices things on the sly. And so verse 8, excuse me, Saul disguised himself, put on other garments and went, he and two men with him. And they came to the woman by night. So they go to her after dark, the night before the battle. And Saul pretends to just be a regular person. He said, "Divine for me by a spirit and bring up for me whomever I shall name to you." Now, this is the way that it's presented to work. And I'll talk about what I think really normally happens. This woman presents the idea that she can reach out into the spirit world with a familiar helper inside that spirit world to find your dead loved one and get a message from or to them through this intermediary spirit that she has as a familiar. Now, what I think really happens is that she either fakes it, that's one possibility, or she simply is in contact with the demonic spirits who are con artists who fake it. And believe me, the spirit world has enough intellect and intelligent information available to them that they can fake it well. You think about how many con men can trick people just in regular human terms. Imagine what the spirit world, inhabited by fallen angels that have been around for thousands of years, can accomplish. All right, so Saul basically says, "All right, I want to hire you to seek out a very specific dead person for me." Verse number 9, the woman said to him, "Well, surely you know that Saul, what Saul has done, he's cut off the mediums and the necromancers from the land. Why then are you laying a trap for my life to bring about my death?" So she's like, "What are you talking about? Don't you know it's illegal to try to contact the dead? King Saul has already kicked out of the land anybody that tries that stuff. Are you trying to get me in trouble?" Verse 10. Saul swore to her by he who is. As he who is lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Now, this always amazes me. He swears by the name of the God who said you should not contact or attempt to contact the spirit world. I will make sure you don't get in trouble for doing what God has said not to do. It's just so strange. And she apparently is willing to accept such an oath that he won't rat her out. Because she's probably got her feet in both worlds. She's trying to balance between this idea of, yeah, I'm an Israeli and I believe in he who is, but I also believe that we should be able to contact the spirit world and find out all sorts of things. And before we poo-poo that too much, understand there's a lot of people like that to this very day. The rules have never changed. We as believers in the one true and living God are not supposed to be trying to contact the spirit world. And yet there are people who claim to be Christians that try to do exactly that. So that's the duality that's going on here in the scripture. Verse number 11. Then the woman said, whom shall I bring up for you? So name your person, and I'll send my familiar spirit after him. And he said, bring up Samuel for me. Now this next part, something happens that scares her. Something unusual. Something that's not happened before. And I believe this is evidence that Samuel actually does show up. That this is out of the ordinary. God has said we're not supposed to be trying to contact the dead. The dead are supposed to be shut off from us, cut off from us. So God makes an exception to that just to make a point. But it scares the woman because normally what would happen is she would either fake it or she would reach out to her familiar spirit and that familiar spirit would just give her a message. But instead of being given a message, she actually sees a vision of Samuel the prophet. Verse 12. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman said to Saul, why have you deceived me? You are Saul. Now, how does she know that? Probably because Samuel says to her, you tell Saul that what he's doing is wrong. And something along that line, and that's how she suddenly realized she is in over her head here because she's actually contacted with the dead prophet Samuel personally, and she's got the king of Israel pretending to be somebody else in her parlor. Verse 13, the king said to her, don't be afraid. What do you see? So this is where we understand. He doesn't see this. It's the woman that's being given this vision. She's kind of been grabbed by God and turned into a prophetess of an unusual sort. One-time use. So the woman said to Saul, I see, and this is the English Standard Version here, a God coming up out of the earth. Now that's, I would not have translated it that way. I would have translated it, I see a mighty one coming up out of the earth, because the word Elohim is often used in Hebrew to mean a supernatural being. It literally means mighty one. So she says, I see this supernatural being coming up out of the ground or out of the earth. And he said to her, what's his appearance? And she said, an old man is coming up, and he's wrapped in a robe. Now, this is just for the benefit of the woman and of Saul. That Saul needs to recognize this as Samuel. And you remember the last time he and Samuel had any official interaction, it's when he grabbed Samuel by the robe and ripped purple fringe of the covenant. So that's a big deal for him to be told that it's Samuel with his robe. And Saul knew it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and paid homage. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? So what are you doing here?" Saul answered, "I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, by either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I've summoned you to tell me what to do." So God won't talk to me. I need you, Samuel. I need you to tell me what I should be doing. And Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, since he who is has turned from you and become your enemy? He who is has done to you as he spoke by me, for he who is has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you didn't obey the voice of he who is and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek, therefore he who is has done this thing to you this day." So basically, you have been so wrong for so long. That's why you're in trouble. And then he reveals one last thing that we'll close with today and come back to tomorrow. Verse 19, "Moreover, he who is will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your son shall be with me," as in dead. "He who is will give the army of Israel also into the hands of the Philistines." So, Saul, you want an answer? The answer is this: because of God's judgment on you, Israel will lose tomorrow, and you and all of your sons will be dead.